This is KDNK, Carbondale Community Access Radio, Glenwood Springs, Carbondale, the Roaring Fork Valley, and beyond. We are streaming live at KDNK.org. I'm KDNK Station Manager Gavin Dahl, and this is a special live broadcast called Your News, Your Community, organized in collaboration with the Colorado Media Alliance. We have community members from here in Carbondale and our neighboring towns who've come to interact and discuss the growing distrust of media at a time when critical and credible information is so important. We have an exciting lineup of media professionals from outlets based here on the Western Slope. Joining me live in the KDNK Broadcast Learning Center are Will Grambois from the Sopra Sun based in Carbondale.
Howdy.
Nikki Turner from the Rio Blanco Herald Times based in Meeker.
Thanks for having me.
Samuel Bernal from Radio La Tricolor, based in Basalt.
Thanks for having me.
Paul Larmer from High Country News, based in Paonia.
Nice to be here.
Amy Marsh from KDNK, right here in Carbondale.
Good to be here.
John Stroud from the Post-Independent, based in Glenwood Springs.
Present.
And Mark Dugan from KBUT, based in Crested Butte.
Glad to be here.
Our objectives today are to give folks an opportunity to interact face-to-face with journalists, facilitate conversations about how news organizations operate, and hopefully build a sense of increased trust. This meeting began before the broadcast, and I'm going to begin by handing the microphone over to a representative of the Colorado Media Alliance, my fellow event organizer, Caroline Fry from Colorado Common Cause, to recap what we've discussed so far.
Thanks, Gavin. We've had a good discussion here so far. A lot of different themes that we have talked about. Ethical standards of journalism, so how are sources vetted, the growing distrust of the profession of journalism and journalists, neutrality in journalism, is there truly an independent news source and how to find those sources, ownership and business models of media and how do you balance your reporting with advertisers. The struggles and pressures of journalism, especially in a ever-increasingly shaky job market. Differences in media consumption by population. The essentialness of journalism for our democracy. Community journalism and what that term community means in journalism, and also hyper-local journalism. How do you choose what stories to cover? And then my favorite quote, journalists, we go to meetings so you don't have to. Thanks.
Thank you, Caroline. And I'm going to start with a question for our panel. What feedback or criticisms do you hear from your readers or listeners? And Nikki, maybe we can start with the Rio Blanco Herald Times.
One of the things, not so much criticisms, but questions that we get is, why didn't we cover a certain topic, or why did we, you know, why did we cover, let's say, high school football more than junior varsity football? And I've spent a lot of time explaining to people how the actual paper comes together every week. And, you know, there's a balance between how much advertising we have and how much news coverage and how many meetings we have to go to, and there's just a limited amount of space, and trying to explain to people how that works and how we determine what's priority and what fits in.
Anyone else want to take that one?
You know, I work for a public radio station in a small, far-flung part of the state. We're really the only broadcast news source for about 70 miles in every direction.
So is that Crested Butte and Gunnison?
Yeah, Crested Butte, Gunnison area, yeah. It's a small department. I have one 32-hour-per-week reporter and then me, and I'm also torn between programming and operations director duties. So we have to, at the end of the day, choose which stories are going to mean the most to our listeners. Now, that could evolve on a day-to-day basis, but there are some issues we just don't have the manpower to cover. Maybe someday we could, maybe through the help of a freelancer we could, but we have to make a choice on a daily basis that there are some issues that we either have to leave off the table or shelve for another day.
Yeah, this is Paul from High Country News. We get criticism often when administrations change and we start covering environmental issues, and people are like, oh, you're just being one-sided, you're just being a shill for the environment, and where's the balance? And I've sensed that more since this past couple of years, where it's like you're either one side or the other, and if you offer a critique, whether it's of the Trump administration or whether it's of the environmental groups bringing the lawsuits or whatever, it's people who want to judge quickly and put you in a box. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important that we air both sides, and we also correct our own work when we can.
I personally have a frustration where I'm criticized for not covering something nobody bothered to tell me about. So I would want to interject. Not only do we not necessarily have the manpower to cover everything, but we're not omniscient. So if you want something in the paper, it's not a guarantee, but you're certainly going to be better off telling us before it happens than after.
For example, emailing news@sopersun.com.
Correct.
What's happened lately is we're hearing from listeners. They say, well, I read it on Facebook. You need to go cover it. And that's, I guess, one source, maybe. Where's the second source? It's our job to go find it. But when I hear someone say, well, I read it on Facebook, you should be covering it, a wall goes up immediately with me. Whether it's legitimate or not, just because you heard it on Facebook doesn't necessarily make it a lead for us yet. It could. Could be a start.
I'm Amy from KD&K, and I just recently covered a story that I got a tip from that was on Facebook. The video went viral about this woman in Rifle who, excuse me, confronted another woman who was hurling slurs at two Hispanic women in the Rifle City Market. And I think that was one of the most popular stories that week. So I think sometimes it is worth it to check out a Facebook tip. You know, maybe sometimes they aren't factual or there's no relevance, but this one was quite relevant.
Yeah, I would concur with that too, John Stroud from the Post-Independent. It's, you know, we have to be careful with the information that gets shared on Facebook or any social media forum. And we always have to double check it and get it from an official source. But at the same time, a lot of news tips do come through social media. And we have a person in our office, a digital engagement editor, whose job it is to monitor social media all day long and to see what people are saying out there and if there might be a story that we want to jump on. So it's become a very important part of what we do.
That said, Will with the Sun again, it seems like misinformation spreads a lot faster than information. So there's often a frustration that we're kind of playing catch up with social media or an expectation that, hey, I just saw this on Roaring Fork Road and Weather. Why haven't you addressed this yet? Well, I have to call someone, you know. So that's something to keep in mind. Have a little patience with us. Please do let us know when things are happening, but don't expect us to report them until we've had a chance to confirm them.
And I think that's especially true with weeklies. And so we're having to use, you know, things are going on Facebook. Our paper comes out on Thursday, and there's a running sort of joke that if you die in Meeker on Wednesday, no one's going to know about it until the following Thursday. And that's kind of true. So I feel the same way. We're very much playing catch up and having to try to use social media to our benefit, like with covering the fires this summer, using social media during the week to get information out to people, to give them updates, to, you know, get that to them, but then following up with the story in the paper.
I want to ask Raleigh a question about that, because Raleigh led the Lake Christine fire coverage for KD&K this summer, and one of the things that I think we learned together working on this was that we got a lot of tips, a lot of calls, and a lot of Facebook messages that didn't check out. And it was really vitally important that we hold off on repeating something just because we got it from one source, mm-hmm. and to try to confirm that. And I was going to ask you if you could talk about, you know, your experience and learning on the job and as a, you know, fire reporter for the first time.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true, which you mentioned. This is Raleigh Burley, KD&K. And I think that I would also like to echo that sentiment of people calling to say, hey, why aren't you doing this? And because we were covering the fire almost every 15 minutes, getting on the air with something. And so balancing that as well, thinking about how people like whether or not it was appropriate. Not only have we confirmed this information, but do people like, is it better in some sense to hold off for now while we like get more information on the subject, and also just to like give a break, you know, have the music and then come through with a more comprehensive update.
One example of that, right? One example of that was that we heard this someone who volunteers at the station said, "My friend just announced that her house burned down," and we thought, "Well, geez, that's a pretty reliable source," but we held off because we couldn't confirm it, and we learned that this person fled in fear that their house was going to burn down, but thank goodness and thank the firefighters, it didn't. So there's an example of, you know, we had a pretty sound tip, we thought, but we used our judgment and waited. And I think that's one of the challenges, you know, social media in an emergency. I mean, my wife was involved in a shooter situation in Denver, and the information going out on Twitter was so scary, and most of it was wrong. And that was a good lesson learned for me. As much fear as I had about that situation, rightfully, you can't trust everything you read online, you know? And I think that brings me to one of the big questions for us is, you know, why should audiences trust us? I think we've maybe made some of that case here, but.
And hi, Samuel with La Tricolor. In our case, with the community, in our community there is Spanish speakers, there's usually very nervous about that if there is a raid with the immigration police. So it's very common for us that somebody say that there is a raid in certain part of the valley, and the rumor starts going on everywhere, and everybody starts texting. And so when we get it, I mean, sometimes I have to leave everything that I'm doing and just drive to the place they say that there is a raid, and usually there is nothing. But it's hard because that's one of the challenges, because people would like, please communicate that there is a raid in this part. Like, I cannot say it if I haven't verified it first. Mm-hmm. And you cannot usually call the ICE and ask, hey, are you doing a raid? Because you will get no answer. So that's one of our challenges in our case with our listeners.
Just a quick interjection here, Mark, with KBUT. And this comes up a lot, of course, especially in broadcast journalism. You can either get it on fast or you can get it on right. Mm-hmm. And we really opt for the latter.
Well, Caroline, I wanted to ask you to bring back to the mic one of the most interesting questions that came up in the first hour of our meeting today before we hit the airwaves. What do you got for us?
Yeah, so we were talking a little bit about media ownership, and there was a question that came up about, well, you know, you need a lot of media outlets rely on the readership, on the clicks. So you want to have kind of, if you're a digital outlet, a clickbaity story. How do you balance out reporting on really good, hard-hitting news with also knowing that you need to have advertising dollars? How do you balance those two pieces?
Well, in our case with La Tricolor, I think it's like a circle, because I've seen that the more useful information we share with our community, it calls more the attention of the advertisers, and you are in the mouth of everybody, and that actually brings you more revenue. And we haven't been yet in a case that there's a conflict with a news and an advertiser. That there hasn't been the case, fortunately. And I've been working for, you know, 2 decades in journalism. Fortunately, I haven't been in that situation, but that's in my case.
You know, it's interesting to me that we seem to be sort of, you mentioned clickbait, and it reminds me of the sort of the accusations of yellow journalism when papers were very much paid by the number of papers that somebody picks up. And it's interesting that that's a criticism that's often levied for a free paper. You're just trying to sell papers with your sensationalism. And I go, actually, you know, it costs money for us to print a paper. We get our money mostly from advertising. We're a nonprofit, so we have some very generous donors as well. But we're almost in between this moment of paid journalism by the quarter and paid journalism by the click. And that's an interesting transition to watch. And I think the hybrids are part of what helped protect at least our institution. We're not a paid paper, but we have very different sources of revenue. And the reality is we're never going to please all of them, and we're never going to annoy all of them at once, hopefully, as well. So that gives me a little bit of comfort when I'm looking at, oh, man, this story might really annoy somebody who's on our honorary publisher list. We have to make those hard calls sometimes, and we have to come. I at least feel that The Sun does its best to see the community as our main support, and the community is going to get the paper it deserves. And I think we try to accomplish that.
Well, it's interesting because Nikki's role and John's role are very similar. They're both the editors. But in Nikki's case, she's editor and publisher. So basically in charge of the finances of the operation. Whereas John, thankfully, in a bigger paper, has a firewall there. I know when I wrote for the Boulder Weekly, there was literally a brick wall. I mean, it wasn't a firewall in a figurative sense. It was truly a brick wall between editorial and advertising. But I wonder, maybe Nikki had a small paper that probably comes up to you a lot because you probably know most of those 6,000 people in Rio Blanco County.
It feels that way, yes. they know me because my picture's in the paper, and that makes it challenging occasionally. We have run into some of that where with different larger advertisers who are also taxing districts, and where we're covering board meetings and we're covering decisions that they've made, and or in one instance we had a competing outlet came into town with a service that they provided, and we reported on it on the front page because sometimes what makes the front page, it makes it because that's all we have for that week. And it made it on the front page, and the advertiser, our local advertiser, was very unhappy and threatened to withdraw all of their advertising. So as publisher and editor, I got to go down with my reporter and sit down and explain, or try to explain, this was news. And regardless of the fact that this is your competition, this is still news, and the community still needs to know that this went on. So news has to triumph over what you need from your advertisers, and you just hope that if you do it right, your advertisers are going to continue to support you.
Well, this is Amy from KD&K, and I guess I wonder, don't you think that advertisers or donors expect a certain viewpoint from the paper they support or advertise in, and would they really withdraw based on one story?
Some do.
Yeah,
Yeah, they get so pissed off, readers or donors. And I think, you know, nonprofit journalism has really risen in the last decade. I mean, I was just reading that report. There's 200 nonprofit news sites in the country now. And a lot of them are funded sometimes by big money up front, a couple of major donors. And you are definitely, I think, more at risk of being beholden to those donors. If you rely on big foundations, you run the same risk as big advertisers. I mean, so what is the agenda? And it's so nice to, we're lucky to have like 35,000 readers who all contribute. It's a big enough base, it's a broad enough base, you don't have to feel like one person or any part of it has a sway, and your job is to piss all of them off at some point.
Yeah, John from the Post Independent, we have lost advertisers over the years because of something that we have written. My experience has been that they usually come back. Partly because we're kind of the only game in town when it comes to print advertising. So, we tell our advertisers that we are going to write stories that the community cares about, that are relevant to the people, and that is going to drive readership to both our print product and our online product, and that it's a benefit for them that we write these hard-hitting stories or informative stories or whatever. And, when it comes to the budget, obviously we rely on advertisers to pay the bills, and the more advertisers we have, the more reporters we can hire, and it all goes together.
It seems like everybody wants you to do hard-hitting journalism unless they're the subject of it.
Yeah, right.
So true.
Well, let's talk a little bit about attacks on the press, because unfortunately this has been a pretty ugly time the last couple of years for the industry, for the calling to tell stories locally, nationally, internationally, and this idea that reporters are somehow the enemy of the people for asking tough questions is really painful, I think, for many of us. Along those lines, I also want to ask you about this idea that whenever you don't like a news story. It doesn't fit your worldview or it challenges your presumptions that you just throw the label fake news at it. Mm-hmm. And by dismissing something that you don't agree with as fake news, you can move on with your day and not, you know, question your own judgment. So I think this probably, you could ask the participants here, the audience as well, but anyone want to comment on that? I mean, do you feel under attack in your outlets? Have you been accused of being the enemy of the people? Have you had fake news labeled, you know, something you've done labeled fake news?
I haven't had fake news thrown at me yet. I've been accused of being the CIA. But, you know, I've also been threatened and filmed by other so-called journalists who have blogs, have been just cameras in my face recording what I'm doing, which is really disconcerting. It's very frightening to me. The first time that happened to me was at the state oil and gas meetings in Rifle, and it was really chilling. But, I mean, I can deal with the CIA thing, sort of, but, you know, I can feel the disrespect of media outside of my usual outlets. It doesn't keep me from reporting, but sometimes I feel like an outcast. And I remember growing up, I used to think there was a lot of respect for reporters, you know, and you could feel it. But, I mean, I grew up in the Cronkite era, but in the Murrow era. But now, there are times when I really feel, I do feel like an enemy in the room. Not all the time.
Yeah, I know some of our reporters have had that feeling at certain events, covering the Bundy trials and the things. But I don't know. I mean, I think there are trolls out there. There are people that are going to harass you and can do it more quickly and easier than ever. And so that's always a disconcerting thing when one of your reporters is having that happen to them, and you're like, oh, we should change their cell phone number, or you know what you know. Somehow it got out, and everybody's calling her all of a sudden because she wrote on a fairly controversial subject. So, I think it's really unfortunate. We're pretty insulated at High Country News because we have an audience that still likes to hear it, and we're through the mail, and we're not CNN. But I can imagine at the local level when you have people. The good thing about local level is people can come into your office and they'll talk to you and they'll say, "Hey, I really disagree with what you said," and mm-hmm. you're like, "Well, you can write a letter to the editor, you know, or or you know, we'll do a follow-up story or something like that." It's when it's this anonymous kind of mm-hmm. yeah. people, millions of people.
But yeah. the other thing that why I'm such a big advocate of everybody reading the High Country News and hcn.org, you can subscribe to the magazine. We have some copies in the back here for folks.
Thanks for the plug.
Here at KD&K. Part of the reason for that is that your writers consistently challenge my assumptions going into the stories. So there have been many times where you've covered something where I thought I knew the story, and your reporters have actually humanized people who, you know, maybe sort of unlock some of the mystery behind so-called villains, or, you know, I mean, the Bundys are a great example. It's a very complex subject. And there are all kinds of, I don't want to say good people on both sides, but there are a lot of stories, and far beyond the, you know, sort of extremist and gun rights people, but just that's one of the things High Country News does really well is it digs deep. You have the column inches to go deep on a lot of investigative and feature reporting, and so I would think that would buy you back some credibility with people, and obviously you've sent a lot of reporters into places where they may not have been welcome, but they've earned a lot of people's trust.
Yeah, I think that's right. When you've got the time and you can actually earn the trust of people on all sides of an issue, at least enough for them to talk to you, mm-hmm. and that's a huge advantage, I think, of going slow. And that's one of the pressures. If you're having to hit that social media story quickly and get it out there, you never really get to that point where it's depth. And so I think that's a challenge, I'm sure, with the weeklies and the dailies, is just being able to come back to those stories and give people the context over time.
You know, we talk about column inches. This is Mark from KBUT. But in radio, of course, we've got a finite amount of minutes and seconds. And particularly when we're an NPR affiliate, as my station is, we try to put our local news in Morning Edition and All Things Considered. That's a way to highlight it, and it also ties us to NPR and you know the cachet they have in the world of journalism. But we have to make those stories fit. So a reporter goes out in the field and gathers 45 minutes of tape, and it ends up being, at times, a 45-second story. At the most, it may be about 4.5 minutes. So a lot of stuff hits the floor. The website provides a little bit of an opportunity to flesh out some of what we didn't hear, but in radio, we have to think about time, of course. How do we tell the story? How do we tell both sides of the story and give some context in a very short amount of time? And also, for the radio, make it interesting. There has to be that early hook to draw you in and keep you in. So that's a challenge we work with every single story, the amount of time we have to work with within the constraints of the broadcast day and with NPR.
This is Caroline with Colorado Common Cause. I just want to interject that that's something that we talked about in our previous conversation before we went live, was for all of the different media that are in the room, radio, digital, print, how the evolution of your media, and has that changed in terms of the amount of seconds you have to cover a story now? Has it increased, decreased, not just for radio, but also the amount of words that you can use in a column? So I basically just wanted to make sure that we're covering the different pieces of all the different media that are in the room.
I mean, particularly for a broadcast writer, they need to know how to write for the ear and the eye now.
Take photographs.
Write out quotes in a print style format, of course, so we've got a little bit more context. But on a website, we're experimenting more and more with longer form journalism. So it may be 4.5 minutes on the air in Morning Edition, but we drive people to the website where a 9-minute piece exists with more context, or in some cases, the raw interview. So you really get a lot of context then. You're literally getting the reporter's notebook at that level.
I mean, Samuel, I know you are challenged by the clock of being a music-focused station and, you know, the commercial radio pressures, but I know you have such a commitment to serving the public. I'm sure this is something you're struggling with all the time, that just how many minutes of content can you fit in?
Our news hourly report is only 1 minute, and so you have to, and I try to cover like 3 different topics in 1 minute, so it's very challenging. Yeah. And sometimes that capsule is airing for like 3 days if it's something that is going on. And they, for example, with the fire, if there was something that they needed to know during 3 days, we'll keep that that news. So yeah, it's very challenging, and thanks to the social media, we can cover more things. That, you know, we have more freedom and more room to cover other content.
I'll defer to the more experienced journalists in the room as far as how things have changed, since I've only really seen the more recent end of it. But one misconception on the subject of room that I'd love to clear up is, the amount of news you have is not what defines the size of your newspaper. It's the amount of ads you have.
That's right.
And so you can have, you know, what people love to call a slow news week with a real big paper that you are going to get into your features and be filling space with columns and letters. And you can have a whole bunch going on and not a lot of room to work with. Mm-hmm. So we are also in print really constrained by space.
And I, you know, I certainly have seen a lot of changes in my 30 years in journalism, and of course, with the online presence that we have now, we do have a digital first mindset. If a big story breaks on in the morning, we're going to get that story and verify the facts and get it out there as soon as we feel comfortable putting that story out there. So this, you know, when you pick up the newspaper the next day, you're reading news that's already a day old. Mm-hmm. And it's you know, online, there's endless bandwidth. We could write really, really long stories online, but our metrics tell us that people don't read it. Mm-hmm. The attention span is like 2 minutes. If 2 minutes, and so we really have to write succinctly and package it. You know, we can put the full interview on there in an audio format, and it's there for people to listen to if they want to. And that's the beauty of the web, is you can put so much up there to give the reader. But and you know, it's the same in print too. We
have to look at how we package it and break it up so it's easier to read and have fact boxes and graphics. And
I think this is an opportunity to ask a little bit, to go behind the curtain with how deadlines work. So the standard articles that are going to be out in the PI in the morning seem like they hit the web around midnight, generally. Is that kind of the routine?
Yeah, you know, just because we are still kind of in that news cycle where it takes a full day to get all your calls back and do the interviews and write the story. For print purposes, our deadline is 5 o'clock for reporters, unless we have a late night meeting that we're covering. And then we have we tell the night editors that there's going to be a late story coming, and so they anticipate it. We're trying to get more in the habit that even if it's a routine city council story and the story's done at noon, we try to edit it and go ahead and post it. Mm-hmm. We're not going to wait just because of the print cycle to get that story out there.
Well, and this really affects the weeklies because particularly both of your papers do such a good job covering local government. And when the town trustees think about meeting on a different day of the week, that can throw off the whole production schedule of the Soper Sun, for example.
That happened before my time, but it was, to my own, you could ask Lynn about it. It was a process, and it was a relief when they sort of moved it back, because our production cycle is arguably based on the fact that the trustees meet on Tuesday, and we want to be able to cover that and get it in the paper by Thursday.
What's your print deadline for your Thursday issue?
5 p.m. is when we go to press, but there's a, unlike the Post Independent, for instance, we don't necessarily have somebody around proof the whole time. So I generally do hesitate to put things online until we've had a chance for somebody to go over them, which happens in the afternoon. So sort of per Nikki's conversation earlier, that Wednesday afternoon is a tough time for anything that comes in breaking at that point for us to get it in the paper. Mm-hmm. So we're really grateful for the web to make that possible and to update things when something changes between Wednesday night and Thursday morning when people are actually picking it up.
I mean, Lake Christine Fire, another example where, KD&K began, we interrupted Democracy Now! On July 3rd as soon as we heard this was going on, and we were able to confirm that the fire had started. But I'm sure that was an example for you guys where your paper was pretty much already laid out by Tuesday afternoon, right?
It was pretty close. And I was one of the first folks on scene for the Lake Christine Fire.
And on the air. Thanks for calling in,
yeah,
KD&K.
It was a challenge. I'm going, wow. Actually, that was the 4th of July week. So we had particularly put the paper to bed in advance because we didn't want to have to bring in a proofer for the 4th much. We were kind of ahead of schedule with everything but the cover and one page inside laid out. We actually had to relay out the paper to get in something about the Lake Christine Fire, which was pretty much out of date by the time it rolled around on the 5th. But that was one of the first breaking news stories that the Sun had covered. I think I did 70-odd updates to our one story online, most of which never appeared in print. So it was we're not a digital first publication. We really are focused on putting out that weekly sort of reassessed and the story behind the story kind of product. Mm-hmm. But we do try to keep people informed, especially when their health or safety is at risk. So it was an interesting balance to try to make, to realize that whatever work I was doing that moment, whatever photo I was taking or interview I was doing, maybe not wouldn't end up in print. And I had to be okay with that.
Mm-hmm. Has that affected you guys with meetings and
same
deadlines?
Thing. We're toying with adding more video using Facebook, although I have a love-hate relationship with social media, as I think we all do. Mm-hmm. Toying with using it, like using Facebook Live, we're having a candidate forum on Monday night for our two contested races. And using Facebook Live to get that out to people in a timely fashion, and then we'll have a story on it on Thursday. So we're having to, as far as the way media has changed, I think we can't just be one thing anymore. We have to be all the things. Now we're talking about, well, you need to do like a live interview. And I'm like, I don't want to do any. I want to play with the words. I don't want to talk to people. So,
John, can you talk about what the PI decided to do around bridge coverage, because that was one of the, you know, the bridge story was huge here, seemed never ending for a while. But one of the things was that you guys set up cameras, right? I mean, that was...
We did, yeah, and made use of some of the other webcams that were set up around town and used those on our website. But we were out there at 6 o'clock in the morning that first day that the bridge closed and the detour went into effect, and we're out there talking to people live. We did a lot of Facebook Live, and we did regular updates as things started to play out with the detour impacts and backups and people going all over the place in town, around the into the neighborhoods, and running into dead end streets and everything. I was a reporter then. I was an editor, so I was out on Midland Avenue, just going window to window to people's cars. It's like, what are you doing over here on Midland Avenue? The detour is over there.
I mean, Amy, do you want to comment on that too? Because I felt like that was really sort of a fun moment for us as reporters to cover the kickoff of the bridge work,
right? Marty Varnierson and I went down there, and it was. I mean, it felt good to be out there. I don't know that, did we do that live?
I think we did.
We did a couple of phone. Did we do mornings? A couple of phone mornings for the bridge, I wasn't down there a lot during the whole thing, but I think some of the stories that I covered, the one that I liked the most, I think, was the walking school bus, what the kids from the schools were doing to avoid having parents deal with the bridge closure. And I think just the creativity of the community was pretty interesting.
Well, and it's another thing that I know for the Soap or Sun and KD&K deal with, the PI can be so comprehensive mm-hmm. that we do have to sometimes get creative of what's going to be our take on this. Mm-hmm. So one of the other things I love that you did, Amy, was didn't you ride the gondola up to Glenwood Caverns to get some photos?
Right. Marty and I did that on the first morning.
If we're going to compete with the PI, we got to innovate.
We got to do something, yeah, because you guys got all the breaking news. But yeah, we went up there to see if we could take pictures of blocked traffic.
Yeah, I've been on both sides of that too, being at the Valley Journal for I was there for 12 years, mm-hmm. so I was in that weekly mindset for a long time. And we would always, if there was a big breaking story, we would always look to, okay, what's that next day follow? Mm-hmm. And getting that human element, the impact of what does this story mean to you? Mm-hmm.
I think we also have to remind ourselves that, many people are consuming the Post-Independent as well. So sometimes my approach will not be so much to get that retroscript to get deeper with it, but to realize that it's been covered. People are sick of it, and I'm going to give some attention to something else. And I've even been in a position where I've called John and said, I think you've got. Are you planning on covering this? Because if you are, then I'm gonna dial it back and I'm gonna focus on this other thing. Because like we said, we're always juggling so many different balls that maybe if we're working together a little bit to handle all that, we'll be in a better position to be comprehensive.
I just wanted to piggyback off of that. This is Caroline with Colorado Common Cause. So one of the themes that I think has emerged is how hard journalists work and how much you work. You seem like you have extremely long hours. I know a couple of years ago when I was thinking about going into journalism, I was looking up job satisfaction rates for different industries, and journalists had one of the lowest rates because they were consistently underpaid and overworked. I feel like that's something that, especially in this modern age of like demonizing media, that we don't really talk about is how hard you work. Because we're streaming live and there are folks possibly who don't know about journalism and have never met a journalist, is there anything in particular that you would like the public to know more about journalism and your work?
Well, this is Amy from KD&K, and I would like, this is a question I get asked sometimes when I'm out in the field reporting, is am I going to be putting the story together? And as a freelance reporter or a reporter for a small radio station, I'm out there, I come up with the story idea and the angle, although, I talk to Raleigh and Gavin and whoever else I'm doing work for. But with radio, I come up with the angle, I go out and do the interviews, I take the photographs, I come back from the field and put together an outline for a script. I write the script and I edit the script, and then, or sometimes Gavin and Raleigh will help me with that, and then I produce the story, mix it down, and it goes on the air. I don't have, and I don't think any radio reporters in the Rocky Mountain community radio network, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think any of us have a producer where all we have to do is go out and get the interview and somebody else does the rest of the work. We have to do the whole thing from soup to nuts.
Similarly, I don't have somebody to transcribe a handwritten letter to the editor that comes in. That's going to be my job. Mm-hmm. We don't have a janitor in the office. If you're the sole salaried full-time employee of a small nonprofit newspaper, I'm not going to complain. I really feel that. No, I know, but sort of what Caroline was saying, that we're overworked and underpaid. I actually manage a pretty good work-life balance, mostly thanks to being a weekly. I don't envy John and the daily grind, as it were. But really, there are many tasks that used to be somebody else's job that are not anymore. And mm-hmm. Gavin, you're not the news director. You're running this station. I'm curious to hear from you on that.
Well, yeah, I wish that, back to Caroline's question, that we had a parking lot full of Cadillac Escalades or whatever out there, because we were all rolling in it from doing the people's work. But
Cadillac.
But that's, yeah, or whatever. Yeah. But that's obviously not the case. I think one of the things that's been challenging for me is to let go again of wanting to tell stories. So it's the general manager's job is not to be a reporter. I think we have to ask Raleigh and Amy their opinion, but I think I've done a decent job of staying out of the way, back to this question of pressure from funders, or do we want to cultivate, say, Valley View Hospital as a funder of KD&K? Does that affect our coverage, right? I certainly hope not. I don't think that I'm biased toward the KD&K bottom line to the detriment of the news department, but it's a very different mindset when you're the publisher. I'm basically the publisher of KD&K in a way, the CEO. And so it's really, really exciting to be at KD&K, because we're beholden only to our listeners. And right now, KD&K has over 1,200 current members. And that is a sign of growth and a sign of, an opportunity for us to continue to attract, hopefully, more major donors. Aspen Public Radio, our friends up Valley, have approximately three times our budget and have about equal listenership. So we both do a lot of important work. They're much more NPR news focused. We're more music focused. But that is also an opportunity for us to grow. And I think KD&K we're really excited right now that we have an opportunity to increase what's the federal match, right? So we get about 1/4 of our budget from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The more non-federal financial support that we can bring to the station, the bigger our match. So we're in a position of growth right now. We grew year over year. If we hit our goals this year, we'll grow again. And that means that for the next 2 years looking forward, KD&K hopefully is going to be in growth mode. I'd like to see an expansion of our resources. I hope that the fans of our outlets will really invest. And I think that KD&K is seeing that right now. We're feeling, and you feel that, But it also, you don't do, I mean, we're not, none of us are here for the money. I mean, I know, and I don't want to put you on the spot, Samuel, but Entravision's been had some major layoffs in the past year. Yeah. I can't imagine that's made your life any easier.
I think when you are a journalist, you will pay to do your job, right? Because right. We love it so much. Well, of course, we need the money, and we do it for money too. It's both things. It's you do what you love, and you get paid for that. So
sure. Mm-hmm. Is High Country News in contraction or expansion? I know you guys have changed the way your newsroom is laid out geographically, right?
Yeah, we've kind of dispersed some editorial staff. We have staff in Gunnison. We have staff in Seattle, Portland, Davis, California. We're kind of in this model where if we want to hold on to talent and someone wants to live somewhere else because their spouse can't find a job in Paonia, Colorado,
sure.
That we're open for it with the new cyber newsroom, and We're on the Slack channel, if you know what that is, and we're all have a virtual newsroom. It makes it harder though, because there's something about the camaraderie of working together, I think, that's hard to replicate. But we've survived a long time on interns. Frankly, we have a great intern fellowship program. They come study for 6 months, and then sometimes another 6 months, and we often hire from that pool. People do it because they love it, and they have an opportunity to write the things they care about, and they can do it in long form often. And so we're really lucky that way. Yeah.
You know, Gavin, you were talking about KD&K, but public radio is on an upswing right now, nationwide, public radio, community radio. Part of that is podcasting, of course, has elevated all of us. Storytelling has elevated all of us. It's easy to do sound rich these days, relatively easy. And NPR is on probably about the 10th straight year of unprecedented growth. So little stations like KD&K and KBUT are riding that coattail by default by being NPR affiliates. So we get the benefit of the NPR name as an affiliate, and we can kind of wrap ourselves in that.
It seems like, in general, the fears of sort of journalism going away 10 years ago have been somewhat alleviated at the local level. I know the Soper Sun is experiencing a similar sort of swell of support, both in terms of advertising and some really generous donations over the last few months. But I also hear that the Denver Post is making money and still laying people off. So obviously your ownership matters in that respect. The fact that we're a nonprofit and every cent we make is going to go back to trying to improve the paper, it makes a huge difference. But also having that support, it feels good to me. I don't know if others are feeling a little bit of optimism relative to how they felt 5 or 10 years ago, but I am.
Yeah, and I think it has to do with the hyper-localization that you were mentioning, that even with all these new media, for example, in our case, people can listen music in other applications, but the local news, they only get it right in the radio. There's no application for local news, you know, or the shows, the talk shows we have. There's also no application that can deliver that content. So I see a lot of hope in media.
That said, I think we could expand massively and still not be able to cover everything that we want to cover. The skeleton crews we've ended up with after the reductions of the last couple of decades turn around to grow back if we're going to be doing our full job.
Well, and comprehension is a challenge. So Soper Sun does a very comprehensive job of covering details like where there's a conflict about a certain tree and the arborist and the tree board are having a debate about it, right? And High Country News can't be comprehensive. They're covering, 40% of the country, right? I mean, and sometimes beyond that scope too, but you know, we have these different approaches. I think it's one of the challenges for KD&K is we've been asked, we don't go to every Carbondale Town Trustee meeting, and we're Carbondale Community Access Radio. What's wrong with us, you know? But part of it is that we are trying to do stories. I mean, one of the hottest stories we've covered in the past couple of weeks in terms of online traffic was Raleigh's story about the Tabor Opera House. Right now, the Tabor is winning. They're in the lead for a major $150,000 historic preservation grant that's based on a vote. And Raleigh's story about that has been shared all over the place. I think we got like 40 shares or something. For us, that's a lot. And so we want to cover Leadville, and we want to cover Battlement Mesa, and we want to cover the broadband deployment from Pickens County and Marble and Redstone. And so we can't always be at the town trustee meetings. Thank goodness the Soper Sun is there. And I'm really glad we have Wyatt from the Aspen Public Radio and the PI's reporters. I miss Ryan Summerlin, partly because I saw him in Carbondale covering stuff. But I know that that's another challenge for us is keeping reporters once you've got them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was going to address that because, you know, the Post Independent and the Post before it became the Post Independent has always been a training ground for young journalists. Mm-hmm. And myself included, I was only 26 when I first came to work for the Glenwood Post. And it is hard to keep people around. I'm definitely an exception to the rule. You know, people like me and Scott Condon have been here for a long time and been doing it. And but you know, most people, most of the young reporters, 2 years, if you get them for 2 years, you're lucky.
I'm really glad you mentioned Scott Condon. I just want to give a moment to shout him out as a reporter for Aspen Times and one of my heroes in the local news scene. I mean, another reporter who was just fantastic during the Lake Christine fire. I know we read everything he was putting out, and it is another thing we didn't talk about today is affordable housing for journalists, right? I mean, my Cadillac Escalade joke didn't exactly
reporters, editors, and publishers do qualify as creatives.
Right. So Carbondale Creative District has been doing the leading this effort with the nonprofit Art Space to look at work and live spaces for creatives, which does include our panel here.
That's right.
But that's one of the biggest challenges. Like, you know, you want to bring someone who's really going to work hard to do this important work, but can they even afford to live up here?
And I wanted to make sure that we covered this because we are talking about Colorado journalism and media and kind of where it's going. And increasingly we're hearing, journalism is in a decline, journalists are being laid off. What are you hopeful about for the future of Colorado media and journalism?
Collaboration. Teamwork. We're all in this together. And as we were talking about earlier, we're stretched thin, and there's lots of stories to tell out there. And I think as a team of dedicated journalists, broadcast, print, online, I think we'll elevate journalism, tell better stories, keep the public more informed, and contribute to our communities.
Along those lines, yeah, better. Good.
Give an example of that during the Lake Christine fire, which we've brought up a lot. We were able to call Will. Actually, Will called us when we were. It was the night when it really like crested over the hill and
July 4th.
Became
yeah, 4th of
more
July.
Intense. And after I think 12, 13 hours at the station, I was called back in because people were panicking and our Spanish-speaking DJ didn't really know how to talk about it on the air in a way that people were going to understand. And so we started giving people the update that had been published in the Sopra Sun, and I believe went to print that next day, the one you referred to, Will, and got a call from Will himself saying, no, none of that's relevant anymore. And he was in his car driving up to the fire and was able to jump on the air with us and explain that. And I think I'm a board member of the Sopra Sun as well, and I think that collaboration has been so valuable to Katie and Kay and all of our listeners and the readers of the Sopra Sun. Gavin mentioned the show that they do once a week, and Everything Under the Sun is an opportunity for them to flesh out some of their content, talk about behind the scenes, get maybe one of the people they interviewed back in for a more extended interview. And for Katie and Kay, it's more local content. And I really see people valuing local content so highly. And I think in the climate we're in, it's where we feel we can make a difference, and it's what we want to be in touch with. So thank you.
Well, thanks, Raleigh. That means a lot. I do think our Katie and Kay partnership is one of the things I'm the most optimistic about on a very local level, as well as partnerships we've had with the Post-Independent, where they run something that we wrote, and a whole different demographic in Western Garfield County is taking a look at it, or the Rio Blanco Herald. I also think, sort of per what Nikki said, I think before the broadcast, I think people are realizing that nobody's going to go blog about the town council meeting. I think if I had to guess why I'm seeing a little more support than I felt that we had 5 years ago, people realized they might actually need us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it was very clear to us during the fire that people were calling Katie and Kay and treating us like a switchboard, that it was not strictly a news tip or feedback about what we were broadcasting. It was like literally Amy and I did reports on pet evacuation and posted resources to the website, things that didn't even necessarily make sense for a radio station to be doing. But it was like, we have six phone lines here and they're all lit up because I have horses that need to evacuate. Where do I go? I have a chicken coop available if you have chickens to evacuate, and everything in between. I mean, the calls were amazing, you know. The other big thing for me, besides the collaboration piece, which again, Rocky Mountain Community Radio Coalition is not only funding a Statehouse reporter,
Been to Berkeley, won some major awards these last couple of years. For in particular, she broke wide open the stories of sexual harassment at the state capitol, which impact everyone in the state, truly. And she's now with Colorado Public Radio. We have a brand new reporter who's just started last week for the Rocky Mountain Network. His name is Scott Franz, and he was an investigative reporter at the Steamboat newspaper for 7 years and is now at the state capitol. Well, that's really good news for the Western Slope communities because it means someone who's thought about the Western Slope perspective, no knock on Benta, she's a great ally of our stations, but this is someone who is coming from the West Slope to the capitol to then think through what West Slope residents need to know. But the other big thing for KDNK has been the expansion of our bilingual programming. We have this incredible partnership with the Indies Inca Youth Empowerment Program, which is almost 2 decades now of helping young people ages 8 to 18 not just get on the radio, but learn to speak for themselves and have that sense of empowerment, and also just meet curriculum. They worked with over 1,000 students in the schools last year, school year, on a variety of different projects, but then also brought over 150 here into the station. And that program has always had a bilingual aspect to it, but where we've really expanded has been largely thanks to Raleigh Burley's work as a reporter and a storyteller who's bilingual, and that means that we're better reflecting the community here, which consists of a large percentage of primarily Spanish speakers. And so that we still haven't done anywhere near what we want to get done, but one of the other things that KDNK has started is a new morning show called Charlando con Cristal, and when we announced that this new morning show was going to be happening, we very proudly featured a photograph of Samuel and Crystal with literally too many awards to hold at the Colorado Broadcasters Association last year. And so, while Entrevision's budget problem meant a real hit to Samuel's ability to do everything that his vision has entailed, it was a big opportunity for us to at least start small with 1 and soon to be 2 days a week of a Spanish language morning show. So I think that's one of the other things I'm really hopeful about is not just collaboration, but expanding our capacity to reflect the people who make up this community. And I think, back to this issue about threats and attacks on the press, this particular group in this room, thank goodness, hasn't faced the sort of backlash that, for example, many women face on the internet if they dare to do a critical story of a powerful man. Thank goodness that no one in this room has faced that kind of hate and abuse and harassment online. But that's another huge issue facing our industry, is particularly women, when they cover powerful men, they get doxxed or they get harassed or they get, death threats, etc. And you can start with this recent Supreme Court situation where people coming forward were then attacked. And so I think while our room is maybe a little safer than others, that's something we need to remember as well. We're pretty much out of time, so we probably need to wrap. I just want to thank again everyone who came out and joined us for this conversation from the community. And I want to thank Will Grambois from the Sopra Sun, Nikki Turner from the Rio Blanco Herald Times, Samuel Bernal from Radio La Tricolor, Paul Larmer from High Country News, Amy Marsh and Raleigh Burley from KDNK, John Stroud from the Post Independent, Mark Dugan from KBUT in Crested Butte. I want to thank my co-host Caroline Fry from Colorado Common Cause and representing the entire Colorado Media Alliance. And a big shout out to Steve Skinner for helping us actually sound decent with this many microphones and this many speakers. This conversation is not over, but we are coming up on 6 o'clock. Will, did you want to add something?
Oh, I just wanted to thank the folks who came out and who tuned in.
Yeah, thanks, everybody.
Thanks very much.
And thank you, Gavin, for hosting. I feel like this is a very important conversation. I hope this conversation continues and community members can continue to come into rooms with journalists, meet each other, and share these conversations. So thank you so much for hosting.
Well, thank you. And I also hope that Caroline will be successful in taking these kind of conversations around the state. So we're going to toss back to the air studio. I don't have headphones, so I can't tell when the DJ takes over. But we will pass it back.